Hello and welcome to the Sonic Cinema Podcast. My name is Brian Scuttle. Thank you for joining me at www.sonic-cinema.com, as well as the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. There you can click subscribe, rate, and review. You'll listen to any of the podcasts, any of the filmmaker interviews that I've done, as well as a wide variety of quick takes, which I've been keeping up with for the most part recently because of the fact that I've been catching up with movies in terms of for your consideration, because I am going to be voting in the Atlanta Film Critics Circle soon, and I have Georgia Film Critics Association in January, so I'm going to have a lot to catch up with that I may not necessarily have enough that I want to write about, but I at least want to say something about it. And you can find those at the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. If you just want to listen to the podcast, you can click subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, basically any podcatcher that you listen to. You can also check us out at patreon.com/Sonic Cinema. There you'll get early access reviews. You have 5 in particular right now for December that have not shown up yet on the main Sonic Cinema website. They're exclusive to the Patreon, and they're some of the biggest heavy hitters as far as the potential award season coming up, as well as Leaving the Collection, Life Soundtrack, and more. And that is at patreon.com/Sonic Cinema. So we are back with another episode in a series that I decided to revive this year as this movie year turns 25. It's the Class of 1999 series. The reason I wanted to do that is because of the fact that I know so many new voices that I did not know in 2019 when I started this series. And so we've had a few discussions with a few film critic friends that I have come to know over the past few years, and we are having another one join us today. The podcast he hosts is Nostalgia Cast. He has been a frequent guest in the past few years, and we are here to talk about Pixar's 1999 film Toy Story 2. Please welcome back to the podcast, Darren Lundberg. Darren, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Brian. It's always a joy joining you for these conversations. I talk, you know, I'm on podcasts, not a lot of podcasts, but every time I guest on a podcast, I get nervous because there's a lot of prep that I have to do. But it's, and again, no slight on you, but it's like with Brian, I just have to jump right in and just go for it. I never have to worry about how the conversation's going to go because I always enjoy chatting with you, and just you and I seem to be pretty knowledgeable about the movies we talk about. So I'm never worried about that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's especially for this movie.
Yeah.
It's a joy joining you for this one.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially, you know, it's funny because of the fact that on the one side, I guess I kind of understand it based on some of the guests that I had on in 2019 and a couple of other episodes that got released later as to why this one was not selected in that first run.
Yeah.
You know, largely filmmakers that I was talking to. But at the same time, I was excited that you wanted to talk about this because I am going to say something that feels fairly controversial given the leaps and bounds that Pixar's made since Toy Story 2 comes out, and that I still think this is very much one of the very finest movies Pixar's ever come out with. And yeah. I felt that way. I felt like it was great at the time, and we'll talk about watching it for the first time and watching it, you know, in tandem with the original Toy Story. And I feel, but you know, I rewatched it for this podcast, and I still had that feeling. I still had that feeling of this is such a good movie.
Yeah,
there are very, you know, we live in an age where it's very rare to genuinely feel like a sequel surpasses the original.
Right.
You know, there's always some hyperbole around some movies, but the fact of the matter is, you're not going to catch lightning in the bottle of like an Empire Strikes Back or a Toy Story 2 every time, or Guardians of the Galaxy movie. You're not going to hit that lightning in the bottle every time. And so being able to revisit this after 25 years really makes it exciting to see that this movie, it has not aged one. I mean, the technology obviously is not quite there, but the fact of the matter is the basic visual aesthetic of Pixar is very clear and very finite even now and in this movie. And that's absolutely remarkable to think about this movie, given that it was their third feature film.
Yeah. Well, again, you talked about why this wasn't in that original run, and looking at the list, this got some very strong movies to get during 1999. I think you said it was very formative for you, but even looking at your list of ones, very strong movies. You got The Matrix, obviously, The Insider, Fight Club, Man on the Moon, Being John Malkovich, The Iron Giant.
Yeah.
To a lesser extent, Phantom Menace, like way down, but still, that was a huge juggernaut of a movie, right? But it's like, looking, a while ago, I did like a list. Let's do my favorite like films of the top 10 of each year. I did that a while back. And again, for NostalgiaCast, we did a 90s season where we covered some of these movies as well. But for our finale of that, I basically said, well, what were my favorite movies of the 90s? And so I did, well, I'll just use that list and all the number ones from each year. That's my top 10, right? I'll just pick those. And when it got to 99, again, looking at all these movies that I've mentioned, so strong. The Matrix is a movie that has become kind of a lightning rod for people looking for their identity, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just an action picture. It's something the Wachowski sisters were onto something else, that they were trying to find themselves. And by doing that, they helped other people find themselves. I can't express the importance and the weight and the gravity of that. So even The Matrix being as strong as it was, Toy Story 2 was the one that I was like, that's the movie that I remember giving me the greatest amount of joy, like pure joy. And like you're saying, like it's one of the best things. I think it's tied. The two Toy Story movies are my favorite Pixar stuff, just because the first Toy Story, yeah, the technology isn't quite there, you know what I mean? But it's still the three-dimensionality of the animation and the way they were able to take a recognizable story and make it universal. There was this shock of the new to Toy Story that was so joyful that it just blew my mind. And Toy Story 2 is the same thing, especially for a sequel, right? It's like you talked about Empire Strikes Back. I sent you the Todd McCarthy review from Variety. I remember reading that before Toy Story 2 came out, and I was like, "There!" And getting so excited because he was so in love with it. And again, he compared it to, this is just like Empire Strikes Back, the way that it took everything and betters it. And I was like, come on, like it can't be that great, right? Yeah. And then again, sitting in the theater, and we'll talk about it, it's like, first of all, it's so funny and it's so breathless and the gags are so great, and they're not DreamWorks pop culture-y stuff. It's like actual Universal comedy stuff. I was laughing my head off last night because it's still so charming and so funny and so innocent and so pure, I guess you could say. But like, and then there are some emotions that this movie puts you through. And so, and we'll talk about that. That'll be a heavy subject. But it's like, out of all these movies that we're talking about, the fact that Toy Story, yeah, to be a respected film critic, you're going to put like the foreign films and the important stuff at the top of your list, right? That's what a lot of people think they need to do to be a recognized or a formative film critic. But it's great watching something like Toy Story 2, and it's so great, but it's also art, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's not just a cheap cash grab, which again, with the whole history of and that's another thing I want to talk about too. It's like in you're saying it doesn't age 25 years. Holy crap. There's a movie that opened this weekend that we're talking that was also a direct-to-video movie that they decided to release wide. But it doesn't sound like, I haven't seen Moana 2 yet, it doesn't sound like they put the same care and effort into that one that they put into this one.
So we'll go ahead and get into this because of the fact that notoriously Toy Story 2 was originally going to be direct-to-video because that was Disney's MO at the time.
Right.
Sequels that are big, successful movies are going to direct to video, and we got the Aladdin sequels, we got the Lion King sequels, we got all of that. But at a certain point, the decision was made, well, why don't we make this theatrical? And, you know, there's a lot of legend about this because of the fact that the film could have was accidentally deleted, but thankfully somebody had on their hard drive, so it was resurrected. And, but yeah, I mean, it's, the thing is, you would never, unless you were told specifically, this was originally a direct-to-video movie, you would never tell by the film itself. So Moana 2, what makes that, I think the original idea wasn't so much that it was a directed streaming sequel, was that it was a TV series.
Right. Yeah.
And they decided to make it theatrical. And it's funny because of the fact that really, I don't think anybody heard about it until earlier this year that was going theatrical around the same time we heard that the live action movie was coming out, which why? Now, that said, I'm pleasantly surprised by what I've seen of Lilo and Stitch so far, and I adore that movie. Mm-hmm. I'm cautiously optimistic about that one, but Moana, I'm like, what are we doing here? This movie's not even 10 years old, and it's already getting a live-action remake? Come on.
Yeah.
But, no, and I mean, I have seen Moana 2, and I mean, what I can tell you is, personally, for me, I think the animation is still really good. And I think the story, I mean, yeah, it hits a lot of the same familiar beats as the first Moana, but there's enough that's a bit different about it to where, okay, I can go with the story here. The big thing that drives down Moana 2 for me is the music. It's not Lin-Manuel Miranda writing the songs anymore. And you notice.
Yeah.
And I mean, some of the songs are okay, but they're just not on the same level as we got in the first Moana.
They're not high points like
no,
they were before.
No. Yeah. And no, I mean, honestly, a lot of the high points for me in the sequel are like, you know, have nothing to do with the music whatsoever. Mm. But no, I mean, I think the thing that makes Toy Story 2 such an anomaly, not just for Pixar, but just sequels in general, is simply the fact that they found a way to deepen the relationship between Woody and Buzz, mm-hmm. while also finding new ways to add layers to Woody and Buzz, having to do with their in-world iconography. And I think that's one of the things that's away from Andy. And I think that's one of the things that's so engaging about this right off the bat, because the beginning of the movie is like completely out of left field. You see Buzz Lightyear in space, and you see him on a planet and stuff like that. And what you realize is they're playing a Buzz Lightyear video game.
Right.
And it's really a hilarious sequence, but then that's going to play in later when they're in the toy store.
Yep.
And you have all the Buzz Lightyear dolls. And it's like, it's the way that they deal with those two characters in a way that you wouldn't expect is really what makes this movie stand out so much.
So there are basically, I agree with all of that. And again, that whole opening sequence is kind of a wish fulfillment, because you get to see Buzz in one of his adventures, right, that you're talking about. And so it's so great because they have so many gags. It has all the robots that pop up, and then they have the robots in their shoulders and the robots in their shoulders. It has the also Spake Zarathustra, the 2001, when he's walking across mm-hmm. the plane. It has the battery, like, as the source of power. And then when Buzz is trying to grab it, it has the lightsaber sound. You know what I mean? It's like, there are so many great gags that you don't, your mind sets aside, what are we doing? Like, what is this? Like, what does this have to do with anything? Because it's so joyous, right? It's so fun. And like you said, it's setting you up for payoffs that are, again, which is part of the Pixar brain trust that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
But it's like, that's what I'm talking. It's when you, when Buzz leaps over and Zurg shoots him, it gets a laugh because he's dead. And then you realize it's a game. And then you realize it sets up an arc for Rex. Yeah. Like, it's amazing that it sets up an arc for him, right? And then that pays off. And then within 10 minutes, they also set up like the themes of obsolescence, which had been planted in the first one, which will be expanded through. But so the main thing that, since you brought this up, that I want to talk about is a great sequel for me. I think this was the movie that finally made me start thinking, what's a good sequel? What does a quality sequel need to do for it it can't just be fun. It needs to be something else to surpass the original. What does it need to do? I think there are three things that a quality sequel needs to do. Number one, and you've already talked about it, it needs to deepen and expand the lore of the first movie. It can't just rest on its laurels, right? It has to expand and move forward. It has to, again, there has to be a push of the story forward. You have to push the characters to get on new adventures. But then you also have to give the familiar, like things that are familiar to it. So you're getting more of the same, right? So you don't want it to... I think there's a pushback for movies like Gremlins 2 or The Last Jedi, where it's such a leap from what the previous movie had done that you're not used to it. You know what I mean? Yeah. It kind of throws you off. So with this one, again, it gives you the... And that's what you talked about with all the buzzes. It gives you that, oh, that's what Buzz was like. It's such... The reason this movie stands out is because it's so rich and it's so... Again, timeless, because they put so much thought into this stuff. When they introduced that Buzz Lightyear toy and he's just as whacked out and disillusioned and just unaware of what he is, it reminds you of the first movie without making Buzz do that again. And then seeing Buzz react, oh, brother, that kind of, it makes it even funnier. It gives it, you know what I mean? It does all these things where it, again, it pushes those characters forward. It expands the lore, right? But it also... You know, it gives you that familiarity in a way that you don't realize that it's happening. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's so rich and you're so involved in the story and the gags that it doesn't it doesn't come off as a cynical. And that's why I think Toy Story 2 might be my favorite sequel of all time, just because I think it makes every right choice and it deepens it in such a way that, again, it's an evolution. Yeah. I can't explain it.
No, I cannot argue with you one bit about that. You know, the idea of this being one of your, being your favorite sequel makes a lot of sense to me. Really does. Because, I mean, this is, for me, like, if you look at Letterboxd, you look at my ratings, this is one of a scant 60 plus films out of over 4,000, 5,000 that I've rated at this point that have 5 stars. It's that eye for me. And every time I rewatch it, I feel that again and again. And
it's like revisiting old friends. I think
that's exactly
the toys are so formative to me and I love every single one of them that it's just a pleasure spending time with them. And
that is a combination of the writing, which I mean, we can start talking about the brain trust of Pixar at this time, and then of course the casting, because in addition to Tom Hanks, in addition to Tim Allen, you have Annie Potts, you have John Ratzenberg, you have Wallace Shawn, you have Jim Varney, and all of them leave impressions in the way that they voice those characters.
Yeah, the Don Rickles Mr. Potato Head is again, what's so great about that joke in the first one is it's Don Rickles, but in Mr. Potato Head form. So it's completely natural, and he's able to do, like, I'm Picasso, and you know, stuff like that. He's able to do all the Don Rickles jokes, and Wallace Shawn, he really pays off because he's the T-Rex, he's this big, again, he wants to be the dominant predator at the end of the first one, but it's like, he's such a nebbish, and he's so, like, small for that. It's so great. You have, again, John Ratzenberger is so great as Ham. Jim Varney, who was replaced later on because obviously he died. But it's like all these voices, they do such a good job. And it's you're right. It's like the writing, it's the animation, it's the character dynamics. This movie is the whole picture. And not a lot of sequels do that. And not just that, too. It's like the other thing I want to mention about sequels is when you do this, I really love a filmmaker that sits down and goes, okay, they want to do a sequel to this. What do I want to say with these characters? Yes. What do I want to say with this story that it's not just a cheap rehash? And I think, again, going over the themes of the movie, which again is set up the theme of obsolescence when Woody gets his arm ripped and then Andy leaves him behind. And there's that whole existential crisis. And again, a toy has a dream. That's crazy to me. And it's so, again.
And the funny thing about that dream is, and this is another thing that The Simpsons has always been great at, and Pixar has always been pretty great at, is layering in jokes and ideas and references that adults are going to get that kids are not even going to think about. Like in that dream sequence, you have the toys playing with all of the cards and they're the Ace of Spades,
which
is a reference to Manchurian Candidate. And it's like, no kid is going to get that.
But, right.
And like
the shining carpet in the first one.
Exactly. And, and then you talked about Woody tearing his arm, being put up on the shelf. And when we see that record, and the great thing about that is like, before we even think about what that could mean for Woody, the toys basically make us realize what that means.
The impact,
they're all
yes.
like, what the hell? How yeah. did this happen? And him finding Wheezy, which I absolutely adore that character. I love the idea of this squeak toy where the squeaker's just not as it's just gone. So it's not really workable anymore. So it's not really a good toy. But and
that's Joe Rampt, right? Yeah. That's Joe Rampt in the voice.
And the fact that his voice is it's like a character is dying in the way the character in the way the voice comes out with that squeaker doesn't work. It's great. And I also love the dynamics because obviously the punchline at the very end of the first movie is Christmas Day and they hear that he gets a dog.
Great joke.
And they're so terrified by what that means. And then in this movie, we see that Buster is
he's one of the gang.
Yeah. And it's just such a great payoff of something you would expect to be something almost out of a horror movie, but at the same time it just works so well.
Yeah, it's the same thing with Mrs. Potato Head. Introducing her is like it gives that again. We talked about Don Rickles. It gives that character another dynamic that's really funny because he's trying to be gruff, but he also really loves his wife. It seems like it's that breaking down of barriers. But again, Buster being introduced—that's what we're talking about. It's like you're pushing the character dynamics forward and you're adding more joy to it, and that's what I'm talking about. Like, if you look at the themes of each of these movies, they're all about obsolescence, just in like different vantage points, right? So the first one's about, oh, like you're being replaced. This one's about, oh, like you're, like you said, the toys reacting to, that's what sells that moment. You get that it's huge. Something's happened, that something big is going on there, right?
Yeah.
And it's, they think through every single moment. And I don't know if they do that as much today, because I know the Brain Trust, they would sit down and they would hammer out story points until they absolutely had everything nailed.
Mm-hmm.
Just because if in animation, you don't want to go through and be three-fourths of the way through and realize, oh, we made a mistake. There's a plot point that we needed to introduce.
Yeah.
And so you can't do that. You have to have everything planned. And again, the fact that the third Toy Story brings that even, again, it expands on that. And it's like a perfect bittersweet conclusion to the story that's been set up from the beginning. Again, they put so much thought that every single moment, like the one you talked about, has an impact, or every gag is thought through to the nth degree. And animation wise, unless you count the Ghibli stuff, I think maybe Into the Spider-Verse was one of the few animated movies in recent years that I was like, oh, I can feel that they're building this from the ground up and they want to make sure that, oh, the story's great, but then the animation, but then the references are great, but then the how you make it more relevant is great. So the layering of these early Pixar movies is unheralded.
It really is. I mean, you know, it's like, I'm somebody who will always go back for Bug's Life. I've always loved A Bug's Life. It's just but that one's just a delight. It's almost a lark compared to the rest of their filmography at this point. And but at the same time, it's like it's such this great reworking of Seven Samurai in a way that we understand the character dynamics in there, because it's basically about it. It's in a way, it's kind of going back to The Lion King, where it's Circle of Life, where it's like, what's the hierarchy of these insects, you know, and how do they fit in? And, you know, just seeing how they work together. But yeah, I mean, a Toy Story, it's always, to your point, it's always been the threat of being left behind, right? I mean, Woody's threatened by being left behind by Buzz, you know, and again in this movie, but in a very different way. And so when he meets Jesse, the prospector, and Bullseye, and the Woody's Roundup gang, it's like, this could give me a different perspective of me being loved. And it's that is such a, that adds so many layers to Woody's journey in this too, where it's like, do I want to rely on just having one child love me for the rest of my life, knowing that that's probably going to end at some point? Or do I want to put myself in a position where I'm loved by millions of children who are going to come visit me and see me in this new context? And I think that is, you know, and then you've, on top of that, you've also got Jesse, who is basically, who's almost the worst case scenario of what Woody's anxieties are about in this one. Somebody who's truly been left behind because they grew up.
Yeah.
And she was unable to really process that, and she's grieved that ever since.
Well, it's again, great point. It's a great counterpoint to what Woody is experiencing, because, you know, Woody just wants, he kind of drinks the Kool-Aid, right? He becomes like, oh, he watches the Woody's Round. How great is that recreation? Again, these jokes are off the wall great. And I don't know how they did that. Again, it's so well thought. Every moment is so well thought out.
Yeah.
But the fact that Jesse, you know, Woody's always trying to do the right thing. When he realizes, because Woody's never had, he's had hints of it, right? Like you said, but it's like Jesse has experienced that full on, and she's not played with. She's not loved. And so she's kind of, the Kool-Aid that she's drinking is the same thing as watching. It's like, I'm going to be adored again. But she, when Woody brings up, come with me, like, he's got a sister, she'll play with you. It's like, oh, that's what Jesse's been missing. Right. Yeah. That's what she's wanted. It's not just sitting in a case and being, obviously being with Stinky Pete and being with Bullseye and Woody, and you're with a family again. Like she says, we're going to be a family again. But it's like she doesn't realize that it's the playtime that she's missing out on. And that's what Buzz has to convince Woody of. Holy crap. This movie is so, again, you say that it's these things are so well thought out. Like you say, Bug's Life is a lark, but even that is, like you said, the hierarchy. It's so well thought out. I just think that the toy, there's something fundamental about these toys and the story that hits me more than A Bug's Life did, right?
Yeah.
There's going to be someone out there that A Bug's Life going to hit more for them than these toys. But it's like the resonance of this, I think that's why today, watching it last night again, I was like, this still puts, even though I've liked a lot of animated movies, like I mentioned with Spider-Verse, this still puts a lot of these things to shame.
It really does,
It's still so well thought out and so well done.
Yeah. No, and the thing is, it's like, you wonder how filmmakers are going to follow up a movie that really, like, the original Toy Story was not guaranteed to be the hit that was.
Right.
Because it was this new technology that we really hadn't seen in feature animation before. everybody was drinking. It was the second renaissance of Disney 2D animation. And all of a sudden, it, and, you know, maybe it's because of the fact that Disney, in terms of 2D, was starting to, maybe because of the Best Picture nomination for Beauty and the Beast, maybe it was the success of The Lion King, they started to get into more serious ideas and more heavier stories at this time that didn't really have the same allure in as far as animated musicals as Aladdin or The Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast or The Lion King. And along comes Toy Story where, well, we're, this is the fun animation. This is, right, this is the fun animation, animated movie. It's going to be fun. It's going to be entertaining. You know, it's going to be something that you have, that you're going to keep thinking about. And it also doesn't help that you have Tom Hanks and Tim Allen at the height of their popularity at this point. So it's, it's a lightning rod that that movie's as successful as it is. So it really does strike you as weird. So, I mean, yeah, it was the Disney, it was the Disney formula that this was going to be direct to video, but it's like, why would you do that?
Especially if it's this good. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Because, I mean, people were talking about Toy Story is, should this be nominated for Best Picture? And it's like, you know, I mean, the whole animated films and Best Picture never went away after Beauty and the Beast. It just was never, it was hard to get one past that five.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Well, again, you're talking about the Best Picture stuff. Again, Beauty and the Beast was such a light, again, it was such a big deal that that was nominated. But again, you watch Beauty and the Beast today still, and it's like, yeah, that's Best Picture quality material. Oh, because the Oscars, they nominate, again, there's been outliers, but they didn't always nominate a certain kind of movie for Oscar, especially when they were doing like the, only the five. And so Toy Story, you'd look at it, but you'd be like, yeah, that's not really Best Picture quality. Like, you want to nominate a Braveheart. You want to nominate Apollo 13. Like, again, talking about 95 movies, right? Those are the big Oscar-worthy movies. But again, when I look at Toy Story, it's so well thought out and it's so well done that I think it's, as a film, it's better than maybe all of the movies that were nominated for Best Picture. It's weird because you think of Best Picture, you think of some, again, Braveheart winning was not my favorite movie of that year, but it was like, oh, that makes sense that that would win because that's Oscar. That's the one you want, the Oscar, the Oscar will want.
Oh, yeah.
Showcase, right? But it's like Toy Story is so much better as a structure and as an experience. But again, because it's a cartoon, there's kind of a pushback on that, right? I love your idea that, you know, Disney with the Renaissance started, like, everything goes in stages, right, Brian? This all of cinema is about stages and about like rewinding and redoing stuff again. 70s movies, which you just covered, and again, that's unnostalgic because that's a big thing because they were able to take old stuff and make it seem new. You know what I mean? So it's every, and then people kind of took up on that. And then obviously, you know, 90s stuff was a resurgence, independent stuff like that. But it's like, you know, Disney, the Renaissance was on its way down. Like, you could start to sense with Pocahontas. I think Lion King may have been the apex.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That really hit the adult stuff, but in a kiddie way. Pocahontas hit the adult stuff, but I don't think kids really like Pocahontas because it seems really serious. Hunchback of Notre Dame, which I, there are parts of that movie that I absolutely despise because it is so, what, pick a lane, right? Be serious or be silly. Don't be both because there's, you're giving me whiplash and it's making me angry.
Yeah.
And then Hercules was a lark. Mulan was, again, people love that, but it was a lark. Tarzan was a little bit more strong, but Disney was on its way down. And then it's interesting, Pixar, who'd been around for a while, right? Steve Jobs, all that. All of a sudden they come in with Toy Story and A Bug's Life and Toy Story 2. And then, and Monsters Incorporated, and they're on their way. Now Pixar is the big thing, to the point where I remember Disney, Pixar, their contract was up, and Disney had to decide if they wanted to buy Pixar or not.
Yeah.
Pixar would have gone on maybe the next Don Bluth animation studios, right? Or Ghibli, to kind of rival Disney. But it's like, yeah, the Toy Story, I like to say that because computer animation had been around for a while, but never in feature length form, never in a form where you see Buzz on that car going through the loop de loop, and the animation, the backgrounds are so three dimensional that you're like, whoa, like that is, you can feel that animation is taking a revolutionary step forward. Right.
Yeah.
So again, it's like, it's just crazy to me that all these, that this, you know, we're starting to build back up and people recognize, oh, you know what I mean about stages, things like that. I'm basically I love that idea.
Well, and the thing is, it's like, what's funny is that at the same time, DreamWorks is starting to build up its animation, and it starts off, you know, trying to have it both ways with 2D animation as well as 3D animation. So you've got like Prince of Egypt, and then you've got ants, and you know, you've got Rodel the Rado. But then by the time Shrek hits, I mean, it's basically over for the idea of, oh yeah, we're doing 3D animation basically from here on out. I mean, that's what audiences want at this point. So, but no, I mean, it's one of those things where, I mean, no, we should also remember that Family Movie was nominated the same year Braveheart won, and that's Babe.
Babe, right, which is great. Yeah,
which
is
fantastic. It's a great movie. And
that's one that people look at and go, why was that nominated?
I know. That was such an out of left field. I mean, you had the critical acclaim, but it's like, how did that get nominated in... I mean, even if that's a weaker year, which, yeah, I mean, I'll give you that it probably was.
Mm-hmm.
How did that get nominated? And then a few years later, of course, George Miller comes up with a sequel to it that is somehow even more beloved than the original. And it's like, okay. But no, I mean, it was, the 90s were a weird time for family film because of the fact that, I mean, like the idea of family live action adventures and stuff like that had kind of gone away. And because of the Disney Renaissance, it felt like it was leaning more towards, oh, animation, this ridiculously American idea that animation is for kids.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we haven't gotten away from that, where it's like, animation is not just for kids. Please get away from that.
It's, I mean, weird,
even
right?
Ghibli, even Ghibli is, I mean, yes, it, you can watch it with families, but it's ultimately very mature. It's very resonant for adults as well as kids. And it's like, it's, yeah, I mean, this whole, I mean, as much as I respect so much of what Disney's put out when it comes to animation, it's like, they've also perpetuated this idea that it's for kids when it just isn't.
Right. Well, I lost the thread earlier. So, but you bringing this up, the adult kiddie stuff, kind of let me bring it back. The basic thing I was trying to say before is, like, you know, we knew that computer animation was around. We didn't know that it could do that, right? It reminded me of Snow White watching Toy Story because, animation had been out in shorts. Yeah. Snow White was a feature length thing. It has the rotoscoping. Watching Snow White today, it's quaint compared to what we've got today. But if you put yourself in the mindset of when that came out, again, groundbreaking adult storytelling that, again, Snow White didn't become a classic because just kids watched it. Adults would watch it, and the Wicked Witch stuff would be, or the Queen stuff would be like, whoa, like adults really jive with that stuff too. It's not just for kids. If animation was just for kids, it wouldn't be as resonant because we've watched, there's been kid movies that are purely kid movies, Brian, that we've watched that have been like, yeah, I mean, that was fine for kids. It didn't resonate with me at all. That's what I'm talking with animation is just for kids. But Pixar was like schooling everybody, at least for that first decade that they were in business, right? Or 15 years. They were schooling everybody as far as what storytelling could do, as far as what animation advancements and innovation could do. When you put up Shrek, Shrek was a big movie. And when you watch Shrek the first time, you're like, oh, this is new and it feels great. And then it lost to Monsters Incorporated, which, like at the time, you're like, Shrek didn't make it bigger.
No, Shrek won.
Yeah, oh, no, that's right. No, Shrek won. Sorry.
It took Finding Nemo for Pixar to finally win.
Right. Sorry, I meant Monsters Incorporated lost to Shrek. But you look at it now, and I don't really like the Shrek movies at all because they're so pop culture-ish that they're of their time. They're not timeless.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's Universal stuff that lasts in there, but those, the pop culture jokes with DreamWorks really latched on, make it just dates it. I don't like using that word dates, but that's what it does. It puts it out of, this was made in 2001, right? But Monsters Incorporated, even though it's not one of my favorite Pixar movies, it's still got stronger themes and character work, plus jokes that are character based and not just pop culture
stuff. And you know, I mean, I think the thing with, it's been a while since I've seen Shrek, so I'm curious to see how he'd feel about it now.
Because a lot of the animation looks like it's still rendered.
It's been a while since I've watched it. Yeah. But, you know, and the thing that DreamWorks really leaned into, and it's weird because Pixar's leaned into it too, to a certain extent, or they start out leaning into it, but it feels like it's not as much of a priority for them outside of like the sequels and stuff like that, is celebrity actors as the voice actors, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that started to be the norm after Robin Williams and Aladdin. The thing that I, you know, the thing that is interesting, and we'll bring this back to Toy Story 2, is that yes, you can tell it's Tom Hanks, you can tell it's Tim Allen, you can tell it's Joan Cusack, you can tell it's Kelsey Grammer, but they're not trading off of their established personas.
Right.
They're playing legitimate, unique characters.
Exactly.
Which you can't really say about a lot of the DreamWorks stuff. Like, they're, like, those actors are very much playing variations on themselves.
Right. And all the jokes are based off of their personas.
Right. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason why, I mean, that's not the only reason, but it's a big part of the reason why I adore the How to Train Your Dragon movies so much is because it's not relying on celebrities. It's relying on story. It's relying on characters. And it's also some of the best stuff that DreamWorks has ever animated. And, you know,
if not the best. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I will, it will never, I mean, I understand why Pixar won for the same year the first and the third How to Train Your Dragon movies were nominated, but it still irritates me because, yeah. but no, I mean, I love that these, and even like Wayne Knight as Big Al, and as Al, and he is, I mean, he's a character actor, so I mean, he's obviously playing off of that persona to a certain extent, but it's not the same thing as Newman. It's not the same thing as the Nedry in Jurassic Park. It's a new character. And I think that, again, this Pixar has been so great about building characters around what an actor does well and allowing them to find their way into the character. I mean, Albert Brooks and Ellen DeGeneres are a great example of that in the Finding movies. And Ed Asner is a terrific example of that in Up. And it's just one of those things where they understand that just because you have a celebrity who's well known in the movie, that doesn't mean that you're done with that character. You have to also give that celebrity something to act. And, I mean, Woody in these movies is some of the best acting Tom Hanks has ever done. I mean, it really is.
It is. You said that in your Toy Story 2 review, and I agree with you. It's like, I don't know if Tom Hanks and Tim Allen have been better than they are here. But it ties them because they are totally invested. It's not just a paycheck for them. They love those characters. That you're talking, even my favorite DreamWorks movie, Prince of Egypt, it still relies on, oh, why is Jeff Goldblum in there? He's not really, it's just Jeff Goldblum. Why is Sandra Bullock in there? Why is Danny Glover in there just to deliver two lines? Then you have Brian Stokes Mitchell sing. Just have him do the voice. Like, Brian Stokes Mitchell is a Broadway actor, right? Like, just let him do that stuff. So even Prince of Egypt falls back on those things. I don't know. I'm sure there's examples in the Pixar movies. But here, yeah, it's Tom Hanks. Yeah, it's Tim Allen. But like you said, it's giving them a chance to become something different. It's not just Eddie Murphy as Donkey being funny, right? It's not relying on their personas for the story. It's they're serving, everything is serving the story here. And that's what I really appreciate about, especially the Toy Story movies.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I, it's like there's, I mean, we've talked so much about a lot of things. You talked about Woody's Roundup. I adore the way they did that TV show is just absolutely unbelievable. And having the strings being shown and
oh my gosh, stuff,
it's such a great, it's such a great relic of something that never existed. And it's like, it's a reference to stuff, but it's also completely new in the way that they're doing it. It's so exciting in that.
The way they do the Lassie joke, I can't get it, but the animals just come on and they squeak a little bit. Toys like, oh, you're saying that the prospect little match of dynamite just in the, and it just goes on and they're like, oh my gosh, such a funny joke.
What's the that, Lassie thing?
It's familiar it's like, tropes, yeah.
What, do you mean, Timmy's trapped in the well?
In the well? It's like,
but,
yeah, very knowing and funny and not of the moment comedy. It's just very, again, just lasting.
And, you know, it's like, I will say, I think Bullseye might be one of my favorite side characters in the movie ever.
He's
so expressive, and he just lights up when they animate him in a way that where he just lights up at Woody. And he also brings something out of Woody, this idea of having a partner that, you know, it's a physical bond as opposed to just going back and forth with them about, it's just as opposed to a dialogue bond, verbal bond, it's a physical bond. It's an emotional bond based on the physical act of playing together. I mean, we see that at the beginning with him and Bullseye too, or Buster.
Yeah.
And I mean, it again, all of this comes back to other things, and it's just absolutely wonderful.
It's like we talked about, it's also adding to the dynamic. It's giving new dimensions to the characters and new friendships. It's not just repeating the same thing. I think the weakness, for me, the main weakness of the Toy Story movies is it seems like Buzz Lightyear, who's such a strong co-lead in the first one, becomes less of a co-lead. It becomes more of Woody's story. So by the fourth one, they give Buzz the story about a conscience, and it's like, wow, you're really struggling to give him something to do here. He just becomes kind of one of the side people. And I don't, again, Tim Allen's great as Buzz Lightyear. That's like his defining role other than Tim the Toolman Taylor, I would say. But it's like, it's kind of sad. And it's not a flaw in this one, because I think Buzz, and I was thinking about, is it a flaw that he's less of a co-lead? But no, Buzz is the voice of reason. He's the one that's learned so much. And again, it's a great counterpoint that Woody has to learn, but it's Buzz that's the good, you know, it's the good, I've got
everything
under control.
Woody has to relearn.
Yeah, relearn, that's it.
Woody has to relearn, because Woody's the one trying to get through to Buzz in the first movie.
Right, that's what I,
and now the roles are reversed. And
yeah.
One of my favorite lines of dialogue in this entire movie is when our Buzz is confronted with the toy Buzz, and he's like, was I really this delusional? it's like, yeah, you kind of were. but no, I mean, I also love the fact that it's like, oh, really? I love the fact that he's enthralled by the belt that the new that the Buzz toy has. And it's like,
right.
Really? Okay. I might have to take that.
That's very Home Improvement. Yeah. That's a good.
The thing is, it's like, it's also basically, I love the fact that like the diluted Buzz toy gets him, traps him in the box. And then as they're driving around the store, it's he's like trying to get their attention, and it's like, guys.
It's also funny that the toys don't even think that it might be an imposter.
Yeah.
Because it's just, maybe the they're toy, so the Buzz Eye went to his head.
At this right. point.
And the reactions to him are so funny. Again, we're talking about, it even expands the Buzz Lightyear lore. I love that joke where it's Zurg and they're fighting and he's like, I'll never give up. You killed my father. He's like, no, Buzz, I am your father. And so because they planted those seeds when Buzz is telling him right now, Zurg is building a planet that has the power to destroy the, they fabric that Star Wars joke into the first one. So this is a payoff off of that.
Yeah.
But again, even the line when it's Buzz saying, you are a toy, which is a repeat of the first one. It is just like you said, it's Buzz telling Woody, you've got to get your mind in the right place, right?
Yeah.
What you're telling me is what I'm telling you now. So again, it's not just for a cheap joke or cheap gag. It's to a point. And I can't express enough how wonderful this movie is, that everything is so well thought out that it's not even a funny joke with the Barbie saying, like, in 95, nearsighted toy sellers did not make enough Buzz Lightyear dolls to meet demand. Again, it's very,
which I feel
a lot
like,
of the jokes are layered which, in.
I mean, I know that it's kind of based on real thing that happened with Buzz Lightyear, but I also feel like that's a reference to Star Wars and the lack of toys at the beginning when that became such a juggernaut as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything's so well, just well sewn in here. It's just, I can't get
enough of this. And the, my other favorite thing, obviously, when they're, the Jurassic Park reference with Rex after he falls out of the car and they make the reference to him in the rearview mirror.
It's like,
it's just absolutely hilarious.
Well, they're not completely devoid of leaning into the pop culture jokes, right? But I think it's not the identity.
But it makes sense within the character of these characters.
Absolutely.
And I mean, that's where, you know, and like, that's why this I Am Your Father is not just, oh, we're you know, ripping off Empire Strikes Back. Again, it makes sense to the characters in the moment. I love it gets to that payoff at the end where we see Zurg and the toy Buzz playing catch.
It's like, which is what you wanted to see Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader ended up doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Wish fulfillment, exactly.
but no, I mean, and I, you know, I love Kelsey Grammer as the prospector, and he really gets to, you know, and the thing about Grammer that's interesting is that he's, you know, he's so identifiable as Fraser Crane by this point, but he also has that way with his voice where he's able to manipulate people in a way that is very charming, but he also throws the gauntlet down at a certain point, and it's like, no, we're going to Japan.
Yeah.
You're saying we're going to Japan.
Right.
And
we've all made the decision.
Well, and the thing is, it's like, but again, this is why, again, all of the decisions of Jesse, of Woody, of the prospector make a lot of sense when they get to those decisions, because why is the prospector's value is as a collectible with the rest of the collection.
Right. Because he's never gotten out of the box.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He was never played with. So, I mean, that's his main motivation for wanting to do this. And it's such great planning on their part. It's
Grammer playing a part. Yeah, he's not just Fraser Crane. He's playing an actual character. Again, you never forget that it's Eddie Murphy at the end of Shrek. You never forget that it's Mike Myers. You never forget that it's Cameron Diaz. Maybe that's controversial. Maybe people feel different. But I don't feel that they are their characters as much as they're just actors playing these characters.
Right.
Even Kelsey Grammer, that bitterness that comes out, it doesn't... it doesn't come out of nowhere, because if you look back, you're like, oh, this, he's telling us exactly where his MO is coming from, right? He's just not as, when he says Sputnik, like, he's obviously bitter about that stuff, but now he's too far gone, right? He's Jesse. Yeah. Jesse is gotten to, because she realized, oh, and it's very quick. Woody just goes, he's got a sister, and that just clicks something in Jesse. And none of these character dynamics, they're all fed off of, yeah, they're doing this because I recognize who they are. That's why they're acting like this.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And going back to Bullseye, I love the scene where Woody is trying to get his arm away from Al, and the Cheetos are spread out, like that scene in Gone with the Wind. And Bullseye's trying to walk by the Cheetos, and it's like he starts licking the Cheeto dust off of Al's finger, and it's like, stop it.
Because he's more like a dog. Yeah, he's more like a dog than a horse. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Man's best friend. I mean, exactly. You know. But yeah, but good God, Joan Cusack, she probably should have won the Oscar for In-N-Out.
She was so
I don't think that's I don't think that's a controversial choice.
Was she nominated for Broadcast News?
I don't think it was. No, it wasn't Broadcast News. It was Working Girl, wasn't it?
One of them. I remember there was a character that was running and she died. I swear it was Joan Cusack. Maybe not. I can't remember. But like, I guess the basic point is Joan Cusack is great in everything.
Right? I mean, of course, Adam's Family Values. She's amazing.
Great villain. Right.
But yeah, I mean, and the way Jesse bookends the montage. With When She Loved Me, where your heart just absolutely breaks for her. It's just one of those things where it's like, that is one of those moments where Pixar just, you know, yeah, Toy Story is fun. Bug's Life is fun. Toy Story 2, this is the moment where we're going to break your heart. And we're going to show you that we can dish out emotional storytelling with the best of them. And everything from that point on is very emotional storytelling. Ooh, and that's, you know, because after that, you have Buzz confronting Woody. And you have that great moment where Woody is watching Woody's Roundup and Tom Hanks is saying, "You've got a friend in me." And it's like,
He realizes
it's like, what am I doing? And like, so much of that third act of this movie is so driven by emotion. That's what makes this special. That's what makes this such a special movie to watch.
I want to talk about that When She Loved Me moment, because like you said, everything is so fun. You have the Buzz opening, you have Woody acting like a hero. I love that part where he acts like a hero and saves Wheezy from the garage sale, and the toys are just rooting for him. Buzz is obviously still a hero. I loved how the toys band together to find Woody after he's been kidnapped. I love the dynamics where they're building up the family with the prospector and Jesse, all those things. So it's great. When that When She Loved Me moment hit, it's a gradual thing where I remember sitting in the theater and I could feel my mouth hanging open more and more to the very end. I think my jaw was literally on the floor because, we'd experienced Bambi's mom dying. And again, it sounds kind of terrible, but I don't think an animated movie had ever hit me so hard where, it can be fun and it can be well-structured and well-designed. But now there's this emotion when she... First of all, it's shot in a way, and it's weird saying shot because, again, it's animation. You just think of it design, but everything has this real golden, nostalgic glow to it. Yeah. And then when Jesse is knocked off the bed and it goes, there's an automatic shift where it's dark and she's in shadow. And you can still see the shadow, but there's a golden glow happening outside her experience, outside the bed where she sees Emily moving around or growing up. And when Emily finds her again, there's a moment where they're in the car and it repeats the thing with the sun shining through the leaves and the trees. And it's Jesse just closing her eyes while Sarah McLachlan sings such a beautiful song. Mm-hmm. And she closed her eyes. And then when Jesse puts her in the box and just sees Emily driving away, I was in tears. And again, I could not believe that an animated movie was doing this to me in 99. Like, how are they doing this? And then you have the immediate thing where it cuts later and there's the Rock'em Sock'em Robots joke, which I laugh so hard because it's such a relief, you know, after hey, he's talking to me, you know, and at that moment I realized this movie is everything. I don't know if I've seen an animated movie that I've loved more than this right here in this moment. Yeah. And like you said, all the emotions, you are 100%, 1,000% invested in the characters from that moment on. And it's because of Randy Newman's music, Sarah McLachlan's voice, singing voice, Joan Cusack's acting, Woody reacting to that, you know, it's, and then, oh my gosh, this movie is so much. And I remember when the movie ended, we'll talk about the climax too, but it's like, we left the movie and like my wife and a bunch of other people went, oh, that was cute and everything. I was like, what are you talking about? It's so refreshing and so rewarding and so satisfying as a movie because they planted all these things that just pay off for the rest of the movie. I was just gaga for this movie from that point on.
No, absolutely. You know, and it's like, I know Randy Newman would win his Oscar a couple of years after this for his song for Monsters, Inc. And I love Phil Collins' work in Tarzan.
Right.
It should have been for this. Like, it really should have been for When She Loved Me. You know, and I say that as somebody who absolutely adored the South Park musical and would have loved to have seen that win. But it's like, no, it really should have been When She Loved Me because that move, that song, it gets to the heart of everything we're talking about in this movie as far as Andy's, not just Jesse's dilemma, but Andy's dilemma, or Woody's dilemma with Andy, and the realization that this time's going to end with Andy. Yeah. And the question is, you know, the dilemma for Woody is, how does he want that time to end? Does he want to end on his terms or is he willing to have Andy end on his terms? And that's the dilemma. And I think it's such a profound moment. I mean, I was 22 at the time. So, I mean, I kind of grown out of toys, obviously, and stuff like that. So, I mean, I had more adult concerns. I was in college at the time. But the fact of the matter is, it's like, this movie really makes you think about growing up. Like, all of these movies, because that's what they are. They're movies about growing up. Mm. And I don't think there's another franchise that has really done that as successfully as this one has. I'm curious to see what I'm willing to correct that when the third Spider-Verse movie comes in, because I think that could be a strong contender. Mm. But yeah, I it's such a deep movie and such a profound movie about growing up that, you know, and the responsibility we have towards loved ones, too.
And your friends and stuff like that. I think all the friends showing up to bring Woody. Yeah, he's going to have fun with Jesse and the prospect. But his friends who are there for him, who are, again, the great gag where they're running across the street underneath the road cones, right? They're even though they don't realize it, they're risking their lives for their friend. And I think that's something that, Jesse will end up doing that. And Bullseye will obviously risk his life. But these are his friends that have come for him. And I think he recognizes a little bit of that, too, that it's not just, he's going to have fun in Tokyo or whatever, but it's like, I'm going to be missing out on some other friendships that I need in my life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That kind of thing. And it's just, again, you're talking about, because it's layered in as a kid's movie, you can do all these. Like, Lion King is incredible because that is maybe the most adult story that Disney had told in a long, long time.
Yeah.
But they do it in a way with animals where that you're removed from it, where it's not. When you have Hunchback in Notre Dame and you're talking about murder and sexual attraction and you're watching actual human characters do that, there's no disconnect. Your involvement is like, why is this in a Disney cartoon? Where Lion King, there's a you can remove yourself from that situation. But it's the same thing here. Yeah, it's toys. Yeah, it's cute, all that stuff. But they're layering in these universal themes that are just so resonant. And I think that's why, again, South Park was great. But When She Loved Me, we still talk about that song today. When we hear the South Park stuff, the, you know, it's, oh, that's cute and everything. But it's of its time, where I think this is timeless. And I, again, you've got those themes of obsolescence, but it has that whole climax. Brian, how satisfying is it where Woody doesn't see the end of Woody's Roundup? He's like, I just want to see the ending. And like, oh, they canceled it. And then he gets to live out that climax, right? And it has the Randy Newman Roundup theme, which gives a full-blown orchestral-like a push at the end when it's, and he's riding on the horse. And it's so exciting.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. And it's, and obviously Rex at the end is like, oh, like I don't have to beat him in the video game. I lived it. Like there's an arc there, right? It's, there's so, that's what I'm talking about. Everything is so satisfying. It's not just a cute movie. And I think that was the disconnect that people I saw it with were like, this is just a cartoon. But it's like, no, cartoons can do just as great a thing with story and with theme and with character that any live action movie can do.
Absolutely. No, I don't remember exactly whether people cheered at the end of this movie, but it would not surprise me one bit if they did. And because of the fact that that ending is so perfect, the way that it, you know, it's like, how is Bullseye keeping up with this plane? It's like, who gives a shit? It's a movie. Yeah. Stop bringing logic
about talking toys. Like, exactly. Where are you?
it's a movie. Stop it.
Right.
But no, I mean, and that, and the thing is, it's like the way they figured out that sequence, the way they made it work, the fact that his pull string gets onto the bolt,
the nut,
and
the
nut, and he can swing down like that. It's wonderful.
But it gives Jessie some agency too. Like she's not just a damsel in distress. She's like, I don't know if I can do this. And Woody's like, just pretend it's the last episode of Woody's Roundup. Let's do it together. And she makes the conscious choice. And I think Joan Cusack even pushed against that toward the end, which again pushed against just making her damsel in distress. I mean, and give her that agency.
I would believe that moment. Yeah. I would believe that. No, but I love that you have that heroic moment, you have that triumphant moment where they're together, and then of course you've got the punchline of that where the other plane is landing and everybody's like, yeah, let's get out of here as quickly as possible.
But then the punchline to the punchline where it goes out the window after Andy's come home and you see the luggage. So funny. Oh man.
Because I mean, granted, it's like, deep down, I don't think you're necessarily thinking about how they get back, but having that visual gag there, it just makes it work.
It's a visual gag that serves the story. I can't express how wonderful that is to watch.
Yeah, and it's something that Pixar has done constantly over the years, and I think this is one of the first times we've really discussed Pixar on the podcast. So I'm really glad that you chose this one. It's such a wonderful choice.
Yeah, this is a bucket list conversation. I'm having a lot of bucket list conversations with you and Jason and Rob. And it's like you talking about John Williams with you, talking about Spielberg with you, talking about Hans Zimmer with you, talking about Toy Story. Again, it's these bucket list conversations, stuff that I've always wanted to talk about. And I hope that my love for the movie is coming across because I just I can't get enough of this thing. And my family knows how much I love these characters.
Maybe. Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, so, it's absolutely great. I mean, I'm with you. I'm somebody who's like, I know there are specific conversations I want to have. Yeah. I know there are movies I want to talk about. And so like basically I'm so grateful for you. I'm so grateful for Jason. I'm so grateful for Rob and so many more people who are giving me the opportunity to have those conversations. And and then of course you've got the big band version of You've Got a Friend in Me with Wheezy having the voice of Robert Goulet. And it's such a great, you know, and I need to watch I'll probably rewatch all four of these before the fifth one comes out, because I haven't seen I haven't seen four since it came out. So I'm curious to see how I feel rewatching that one. But I find it, I'm endlessly amazed that they at least made a third one that didn't screw up the perfect ending they had with two.
Yeah. It completes a story you didn't realize that they were building to.
Yeah. Right? And the fourth one, I mean, again, why remember of it? It's like, it's fine. It's really good. It gets to some of the emotions, but it just doesn't hit the same way. Or it didn't at the time. But that said, it was also the last movie I saw in theaters with my mom. So there's going to be an added emotional level to that as well. This was such a... I'm so glad you discussed this one.
It's like a gift, because when you asked me if I wanted to be a part of this, I was like, well, what movie can I choose? And I was looking at all of them like, what? Toy Story 2 is not on this list. I was like, it must be meant for me, right? I was like, because that's the movie that I want. Again, talking about how you have all these other great movies, but it's like, yeah, I love all these. I love Man on the Moon, like, is a great one. I love The Insider. All these movies, I love them, but it's like none of them got to my heart like Toy Story 2 did. And you're talking about, I don't know. What do you think? The last thing I want to ask you on this: what do you think of the animation? Of the evolution. I push against people with the first movie. Again, it means something to me, and Toy Story 4 means something to you because you saw it with your mom. But like, Toy Story means something because of the story and engaged me. But like, when people nitpick, oh, the humans look weird, or the dog looks weird, or they didn't have that stuff. It's like, yeah, I mean, the technology wasn't there, but it's like, I would have rather them do the movie instead of wait 10 years because the themes and the story.
I think, you know, look, animation, if you're criticizing a great animated movie for its animation without recognizing that it was very much the state of the art of its time, or at least you hope so. Yeah. And I mean, Pixar's always pushed, you know, I remember especially at first decade or so Pixar animated features, they were always pushing the envelope in some way. And no, I mean, like I said, this is one of the 60 or so 5-star movies I've ever rated on Letterboxd. And yeah, the animation looks even more spectacular to later movies, but this one works. This one is legitimately great because of what the animation looked like at the time. It's like, here's another thing I will say. I don't think, unless this character, this story is not about the humans.
Right.
I think if the story is about the humans, that's another thing. And I think that's what makes the Incredibles so great, because of the fact that they use that as an opportunity to push forward what they were doing with humans.
Right. And but even then, it's stylized for Incredibles. Exactly. So it works. Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, if you're not telling a story where the humans are the main characters, why does it matter how the humans look? I mean, honestly, I've never had a problem with it in these movies. I'm never like, oh, well, the animation looks weird on Andy and stuff like that. But it's like, Andy's not the main character. Andy, he really isn't.
He's not. I think the thing is, like, again, I push back on that because, yeah, it doesn't look great, but it's a dog. Like Spud, I recognize as a dog. I recognize as humans. Like that doesn't matter to me. Yeah. If it didn't look like a dog, and if the story didn't hit me, then the animation would bug me. It's kind of song. If the music in a song isn't doing it for you, you start paying attention to the lyrics, and I think that's a mistake. Like, and if the lyrics are bad, then it's even worse. But and then Toy Story. So the first Toy Story, I guess if I would have done anything different, I would have maybe not shown their faces. You know what I mean? Maybe if you don't have the technology, maybe don't lean into that. That kind of thing. Maybe there's a more creative way to do it. But again, I can't complain about that. This one, again, the animation on Al when he's sleeping and he's snoring and Woody's right there against his face is like, oh, that almost looks photorealistic. That's how good that this is. The animation.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's just like you – and again, the animation in the first two movies can't compare – you can take any shot of the fourth Toy Story and it's like, oh, it's so much. Again, it's another evolution. It's another plane of existence. But the story in Toy Story 4 didn't engage me as much as the first three movies, so the animation doesn't matter to me. You know what I mean? It's not the selling point. The fact that the third movie is about Andy and is about humans interacting with these toys, if the humans had looked the same in the first Toy Story that they did in the third, I don't think the emotions would have landed in Toy Story 3. There's a moment where Andy gets in his car and he looks back and the little girl, what's the little girl's name in 3? I can't remember.
Bonnie,
yeah. She waves Woody's hand, and there's a moment where Andy catches his breath. And I think that's a universal thing you've realized when you're missing a friend and you're, you know, and it just hit me so hard. If the animation on Andy had not been so great because of The Incredibles, because of all these other things, Ratatouille, stuff like that, I don't think they would have sold that moment. And so that's a great point to bring up. When it's not about the humans, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And I mean, also it's like Disney was not Disney right off the bat. I mean, granted, you know, they had Pinocchio, they had Fantasia in the same year, they had Bambi, they had Cinderella, they had Sleeping Beauty, they had a lot of great movies early on. I mean, even you, like you were saying, Snow White, I mean, it's definitely not as impressive as it had to have been in 37, but it's still pretty damn good for a movie that's almost 8 years old, or almost 9 years old now.
And I think it's because Disney was innovating. So even though it's kind of quaint, it still means something.
If as an animation unit, they were not constantly pushing forward, we would not be thinking about how hard the emotions or the stories would be hitting us because of the fact that, well, they're not pushing forward. And I mean, that's kind of the issue with a lot of DreamWorks films, right? Where it doesn't necessarily... That's part of why How to Train Your Dragon hit so hard for me, because it feels like, oh my God, this is a quantum leap compared to what they've been doing.
Yeah. Because they're putting story first and character first, not just jokes.
But
the jokes...
But also the animation feels completely different from they've been doing.
Yeah, the jokes should be at the service of the story and the characters. It shouldn't be the point of your movie, because then it's not going to last. How to Train Your Dragon, again, beautifully rendered, beautifully characterized, beautifully written.
Those
How to Train Your Dragon movies, again, are on Pixar, early Pixar level, I would say.
Yeah.
Which is weird, because DreamWorks, they seem to do a really shit one and then a really great one, and then it's just weird that they can't get on the same page.
But no, I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, Pixar's had its lulls at times, but I think they still manage to come up with really strong ideas more often than not. Yeah. I mean, I was very pleasantly surprised by Elemental last year.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, wow, okay. I see where they're going. And I mean, you know, Coco was a movie that impacted me. Up is one of my favorite movies of all time, and I mean, there are emotional reasons for that. Wall-E is another movie that I think is just a quantum leap for them in a lot of ways. And you know, but yeah, I mean, it ultimately will always come down to the Toy Story movies for Pixar. And
they set the standard.
Yeah, they set the standard. They changed the standard, I think, is the opportune thing. They pushed the standard forward. And I think that is one of the things that makes this movie in particular, timeless.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, the animation may not be as impressive as it was 11 years later in Toy Story 3. But the fact of the matter is, the emotions are there. That's ultimately what counts. And, you know, if you can stomach it because of the fact that the commentaries do have a lot of John Lasseter on them, I do recommend listening to those commentaries where they're talking about this stuff. And yeah. I listen to those commentaries constantly, and it's remarkable to hear how they approach these movies.
Yeah, it's the, you've always got the problematic stuff. Seems like everybody's going to have those issues the longer we go on. But it's like, yeah, Lasseter was a big hero of mine for the longest time. And I think, again, it's hard to grapple with the art versus artist kind of thing. But it's like, as long as, you know, we focus on the innovation that he did, and again, it ground level stuff, the way that he was able to lead, at least the beginning before, you know, and all the cracks artists and all that stuff before he had to leave all that stuff. It's like, yeah, he was a hero to me. It's disappointing all the stuff that's happened, but it's like, I'm still going to cherish that he was able to spearhead something and give this gift to me as a movie. Even Cars, his love of NASCAR and racing comes through in that one, where it's a weird world. Yeah. But it's like, it's very personal filmmaking.
Yeah,
and I think that's what's missing a lot of time in animation. There are just a lot of filmmakers, not just animation, Brian, are worried about impressing you in the now. They're not worried about what's going to last 20 years from now. I don't know if Pixar sat down with their brain trust and said, we want to make this last, or if they're just trying to make the best story possible for that moment, like without any cynicism or anything, just trying to make every moment work. And that's what makes it last. I don't know if they made a conscious decision to say we want to be around in 30 years, or if they're just so good that that's why they're still around in 30 years. I've loved a lot of Pixar movies since Toy Story 2, but like I said, these first, and Incredibles comes up third probably as far as my favorites go, but it's like no Pixar movie has matched the level of these first two movies for me. And again, this is, whenever I watch Toy Story 2, I'm like, this has got to be the greatest sequel I've ever seen, because it does everything I personally need a sequel to do.
Yeah.
And it doesn't end on a cliffhanger or anything. It tells a complete story.
Yeah.
And even Toy Story 3, there are some issues I have where it repeats some of the same stuff that this one does. But it's like they still layer in a plot you didn't realize. Andy saying goodbye to his toys, or finally seeing that goodbye, is so heart-wrenching that these three movies are just everything to me.
Yeah, absolutely. On that note, Darren, as always, thank you very much for joining me. I've loved the conversations we've had this year. We had the conversation earlier with Johnny about nostalgic classics, and we got to talk about some of our favorite movies that predate us in terms of movies that came out before we were born and how we respond to them at certain points in our lives. And then this one, I mean, this one feels very, in a way, it feels very simpatico with that conversation, but in a very different way. And as always, is such a pleasure to talk to you.
We need to do it more often. I always say that
we do. And I mean, we need to figure out what we're going to talk about in 2025.
You've had Brian Ackley and Jacob Polinsky on a couple times for this particular series. There's no reason that
exactly.
I should be able to talk about more movies.
Yeah, we can and Chris Esper. I mean, I've had a lot of repeat guests, but I mean, the reason they're repeat guests is because of the fact that I enjoy talking to them. And I mean, not that the people who were only on once or twice, I didn't enjoy talking to them. It just worked out that the timing on some of these worked out the way that they did.
Kevin as well.
Yeah.
Talking about him.
And Rob. And I mean, we've got one more for this we're adding after this one. So I'm looking forward to that. Darren, where can people find you?
Well, I'm still on, I'm so old, Brian, I can't just leave Twitter. So I'm still on there. I'm trying to make the transition to Blue Sky, but I don't have as much interaction there still. I'm trying to build something there. But again, just find Nostalgia Cast or Back to Bluey on Blue Sky, because they have a longer kind of handle. At Twitter, it's at DW Lemberg. Again, Nostalgia Cast run with Johnny, my childhood best friend. We're going to dive back. We're in a break right now. We're going to dive back into 90s movies again, talking about Toy Story being a bucket list conversation. We're going to make this new season a bucket list 90s movies about movies we've always wanted to talk about. So please tune in for that. And then Rob and I are still going with, talking about, we talked off air about positivity. So Rob and I run the Back to Bluey podcast. We talk about Bluey and how, what it does to us as fathers and parents and remembering childhood and how we grew up, stuff like that. In this age of everybody's down, everybody's so dour, everybody's so downtrodden. Like, if you're looking for a positive experience, check out Sonic Cinema, but also go check out our conversations at Back to Bluey. We're just trying to talk about uplifting, just universal, just good positive stuff and good positive role models. Please join us over there.
Yeah. And I mean, just any discussion with Darren and Rob, I mean, it's always worth checking out. I asked Rob about Back to Bluey when I am on for Deep Blue Sea, and we talked about that for a little bit. And I don't have kids myself. So it's like, I have not watched Bluey. So
you'll get addicted.
You don't need something else to be addicted to. I have no doubt it's a must listen podcast just because you two are in it. Thank you very much for the kind words. I look forward to you guys continuing on with the 90s and Nostalgia Casts. And I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. I was so looking forward to this conversation, Brian. Again, you never disappoint. This conversation didn't disappoint. I've had such a, thank you for letting me come on and talk about this movie. I had such a great time talking about this with you.
Oh, I always have a great time talking with you as well. And I want to thank Darren for joining me on the podcast. And like I said, we've got one more class of 1999 for this year. And then we're actually going to have Phil Fasso back on. We're going to have a very different slant on Christmas movies with Phil. And I'm looking forward to sharing that discussion with you. That's going to be it for the Sonic Cinema podcast this episode. Join us wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Goodbot, or the YouTube channel. Also check us out at patreon.com/Sonic Cinema. But first and foremost, check me out at www.sonic-cinema.com.